Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And of course, we're going to lead off today talking about the Democratic presidential debate that took place last night. Many of us were up watching it. If you were, I'm curious to see what you think. If you, with your analysis and thoughts at 410-319-8888, write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages. But do join us, 410-319-8888. I sent out a lot of tweets last night and got a lot of responses from across Baltimore and across the country. I want to hear your thoughts now at 410-319-8888. We're joined in studio today by Bhaskar Sankara, who is founding editor of Jacobin, senior editor of In These Times. It's been on the show numerous times, but first time in studio. Good to have you here, Bhaskar. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And last night he joined Delegate Jill Carter, who represents our 41st district here, at the Real News in their discussion post-debate. Good to have you in the studio, Jill. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Marsha Reeves Jews joins us, of course, host of Keep It Moving, right here on WEAA every Monday night. Marsha, welcome.
Hello. Good morning.
Good to have you as a guest.
Yes.
Eleni McAllister joining us from Pittsburgh, Republican strategist, former congressional candidate, a host of Night Talk and Get It Right with Eleni McAllister. Eleni, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me again, Mark.
410-319-8888. So, Bhaskar, you're in the studio. Let me just throw this out to you. What to me was interesting, a little sidebar, is I've never seen a presidential debate in my years and decades of watching them where the question of socialism came up.
I'm sure it has came up before, but it's
not like
more.
This.
Yeah, like there's a bunch of Nicaraguans about to invade Texas. You know, I'm sure it used to come up a lot, but not in this context. And I think that's a real strength and difference that having Sanders in this debate makes, and that's the reason why I'm supporting Bernie Sanders.
So one of the things that struck me though about that is, and some of the other issues that were raised in that debate, is that clearly when you can see that the Democrats, Jill, have been pushed to the left, partially by Bernie Sanders, but I think also partially because of the growing new base of the Democratic Party, increasingly young, increasingly people of color. And I think there's a shift that's Bernie Sanders, but in some ways beyond Bernie Sanders.
There's definitely a push. It's the era that we're in. But I think, the cautionary tale that we have and history would show that there is always that one populist, socialist person that appeals to the people within the Democratic primary, the candidates. And usually that person is someone that we all like a Dennis Kucinich or initially a John Edwards, now a Bernie Sanders. But ultimately that person doesn't win, can't win. But what they do, what they serve to do usually, and we have to be worried, concerned about it, is they just serve to expand the base, get more people interested that are would likely be turned off to Democrats, and then ultimately leave us in the situation that we always wind up in, the lesser of the two, some would say, evils of the Democrat nominee versus the Republican, because the Democrat's always going to be the better choice for people that feel – that agree with the Bernie Sanders of the world.
Marsha, how did you see that last night?
I think that Bernie has some really great points, and America, middle-class America, lower-income people are tired. And it's unconscionable that there's only a certain percent of this world, this country, who have control over everything. And people are tired of it. They're tired of everything being so expensive. They're tired of their wages being low. They're tired of trying to get an education so that they can do better, but they can't afford it. People are just tired. And while we bant these terms around, socialism is really about the social justice that we need as a people. And we're not getting that from anybody. And so at some point, Americans are like, why am I voting? That's why the turnout here, particularly in Baltimore, was so low. Why am I voting? Why do I bother? Who is really representing me? And we have to make some hard choices in terms of our own parties of what's their real purpose and how are they really set to support and to undergird the country. It's the country. It's Americans. And it's unconscionable that Americans are being treated more like third world country citizens. And so we have to really think about that. It's how do you have vacant homes all over this country and high homelessness? How do you have children who are graduating from school, high school, functionally illiterate? How do we have a disproportionate amount of income going to incarceration versus education? And how do we allow paid for-profit corporations on NASDAQ to make money off of the lives of our citizens? I mean, we have some real hardcore issues that we all must address.
And Lenny, I'm curious from your perspective as a Republican how you saw that.
How I saw what? Just the debate playing out overall, or what particularly about the debate? Just the conversation in regards to income inequality? I mean, this is one thing that I think that the Democrats so far, let's start with that, I think that the Democrats so far is going to continue to have, I dare say, even a little bit of a monopoly on. I think that we as Republicans haven't done a very good job of speaking to that very directly and bringing about solutions that are easily digestible. It's very easy within 30 seconds of a debate to say, you know, for example, the top 1% own or control 90% of the wealth in the United States of America. That's very easy to digest within 10 seconds of a statement versus the types of solutions that oftentimes Republicans try to bring up in these scenarios to bring about how they're going to shift this. I think that the Democrats, everybody on the stage, did a fairly good job of doing that. Now, in regards to what transpired last night, I think that everybody's running to the left. Now, Hillary Clinton needs to be mindful that that's not the race she wants to run. I think that she did a better job than the others of pointing back to who her real competition is going to be if Joe Biden doesn't run into this race, which is going to be Republicans and whoever the Republican nominee is. And she's going to have to be mindful not to try to outflank Bernie Sanders, because although the demographics within the Democratic Party are shifting, she still has to run the United States of America. And in order to grow the black middle class, who will end up being more moderate, she's going to have to bring about some solutions that everybody gets on board with, not just the progressives that she's trying to get as a, you know, as of last night, self-proclaimed progressive that was just proclaimed a moderate just a week ago.
Buska?
Well, I loathe to agree with a Republican, but I think that makes perfect sense as far as Hillary Clinton, her co-calculus. I mean, she's an establishment candidate, and she's is running to win, and her campaign will not be a success unless she wins and wins with a fairly healthy slice of the vote, at least as well as Obama did in 2012. Bernie Sanders, though, I think his contribution is bringing in a lot of ideas and mobilizing, you know, a base of 600+ thousand individual small donors, average contribution around $30, you know, having this huge network of viewing parties, of people engaged on the ground, of affiliate campaigns like People for Bernie. So I think there is kind of two different things. And I think the real danger with Sanders and the trap that he has to avoid, which is kind of parallel to the trap that Hillary Clinton has, which is trying to outflank Sanders and trying to be something she's not, you know, be actually, you know, someone on the left, is Sanders trying to modulate his politics and the whole core of his appeal, which is as the outsider who's not afraid to directly tackle inequality and all these other things that Hillary Clinton will just by nature dance around.
But I think that it's interesting to me to watch both Hillary Clinton and especially former Governor Martin O'Malley dance to the left. Especially watching Governor Martin O'Malley dance to the left.
Well, you know, it's disingenuous in terms of what each of their history has been. Well, O'Malley certainly had a few progressive initiatives. Of course, he takes all the credit. I would argue that the legislature and the people of Maryland pushed very hard on some of those things he takes claim to. But, you know, I just don't really feel, as I'm hearing others, that we are in danger of Hillary moving to the left. I think she's going to stand, as she says, she's going to stand her ground and maintain her place in the middle. And I think that the purpose that Sanders serves is to solidify Hillary as that moderate candidate that people can that donors can continue to embrace. And so I really think that it's – again, I just really think it's something that we've seen in the past. You know, we've seen in the past, you know, the Two Americas campaign. We hear all of this rhetoric every 4 years, every time there's a race. But at the end of the day – the Democrats and the Republicans have both been contributors to our current plight, to the income inequality, to the mass incarceration, and all of the other issues that Bernie Sanders' campaign speaks to.
I think that it's curious how this plays out in the general election. I watching this debate right now, I mean, all the pundits have given the winning nod to Hillary Clinton in this debate. I mean, she did come across very smooth, very clear, unruffled, and presidential, quote unquote. Got most of the time on the podium as I was watching, just debate question, political question. She got 37 minutes on stage. Poor Lincoln Chafee got 9 minutes. So I felt so bad for him. I just personally felt bad watching him on that stage. But I think in some ways, as a Republican debate seemed to focus on Donald Trump, this debate focused on Hillary and Bernie, and then a little bit to O'Malley. Even the questions, who they went after, it's like the others were kind of left out in the wings. As we're letting you in, but you're really not that important to us, Marcia.
You know, I'm glad you called on me. I was really glad they did. We really needed to hear from each individual and what their positions were and who they are. As I sat and I listened to Webb, man, thank you for your service, but he has been a Republican. You know, all these people that are coming in and out, changing, same thing with Chafee. Today we're going to be a Republican. Well, we might try to be an independent. We don't know what we're going to do. Since I can't get in the race, let me just go ahead and be a Democrat. And so I just think that we need to look at somebody who is really going to give their best authentic self. The reality is that we're in a serious crisis, not only from a world standpoint, but up here, not only abroad, but local and nationally. We need a leader who is going to be able to take the hard questions, who can make the hard decisions. Who do I really want in that war room? Who do we really want to be able to represent us when we sit in front of all these nations? And so what are you bringing to the table that makes us comfortable? I don't want to hear about all the negative energy that a Republican debate has where people are talking about each other. Tell me about who are you? What are you telling us? What are you really going to do to change this country? And why should I get up out of my bed and go and vote for you?
Now, I think the Democratic debate was more about issues than the Republican mm-hmm. debates that yeah. we've seen so far. One of the things that's clear to me when you talk about war rooms, pardon me, is that none of the candidates seem to have any understanding of what to do about the Middle East at all.
It's
none
huge.
Of them. None of them had
huge,
a could
right.
even it couldn't even begin to figure out what a response should be to the idea of Russia in Syria, to how to handle Islamic State, to what it meant. The debate around who voted for and who did not vote for the Iraq War, and how that that foreign policy move in the Bush administration helped create the world we're seeing now. So, I mean, but none of them seem to be able to put their hands around this at all.
And surprisingly, Jim, I thought Webb was going to really be able to get his teeth in it. You know, you're the, you know, Semper Fi. What happened? I really thought he was going to.
Well, he had to wait 10 minutes, and then he couldn't get a chance. But I think that I think that was very telling, and I think that probably as the race continues, they'll focus more on substantive issues because, quite frankly, there was all throwing out a lot of talking points or a lot of like phrases, but there was no real substantive mm-hmm. discussion about implementation of anything. But I definitely got to give it to, and this isn't in by any way endorsement or support, mm-hmm. but I felt that of all the candidates, Hillary was the only one there with any real experience and ability to really speak to issues, right or wrong. I think O'Malley and the other candidates just simply aren't equipped with that.
Well, she's going to have a problem. And the problem she's going to have is she's not going to have in October, she's not going to have in November unless if Joe Biden gets in the race, she's not going to have until next summer is this. She started hitching her wagon to the Obama foreign policy legacy starting last night.
Mm-hmm.
And by
yes.
doing that and then turning around and asking, why do we have Russia and Syria when mm-hmm. you were sitting there holding the shiny red button saying we're going to reset relations in 2009 while you were Secretary of State? That reset seems like you blew up relations, not reset relations. That's going to be something that's going to come up next year. When you start talking about what transpired in the Middle East when it comes to the Iranian deal that a lot of people here in the United States don't like, that was a partisan deal that was passed. When people start start looking at the Israeli-Palestinian tensions that are rising again. A lot of that happened and started percolating under her watch. The tone between Bibi Netanyahu and President Obama happened under her watch. What's going on with the Chinese happened while she was Secretary of State. That mood started shifting there as well. She's going to have some questions to answer, and she's been able to get off the hook with this because the Democrats played nice with her. It was not a competition last night. It was a coronation last night.
Unless
Joe Biden gets into the race, you're not going to see Democrats really come after her hard, because the only person that tried was poor Lincoln Chafee. And anytime we continue to add the adjective poor in front of Lincoln Chafee, that tells you how strong the competition's been for her so far.
But I think going back to that, Bosco, the whole question of foreign policy here was a huge one. And it would come back to not being able to put your hands around these issues. And while she, of course, is in some ways hitching her foreign policy bona fides on her work with Obama, we're talking about an extension from Bush and the Republicans to this, and nobody knowing how to respond to this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this is one of the weaknesses of Sanders, because when it comes to these other issues of how do you handle Wall Street, for example, these other candidates are seeking very minor technocratic fixes. Hillary Clinton's almost explicitly seeking the status quo, you know, Dobbs-Frank enforced a little bit more and so on. But Sanders was able to come in and say something quite a bit different to really differentiate himself as a candidate. But the truth is, on foreign policy, Sanders is no radical. He's a regular run-of-the-mill liberal Democrat. There's far worse people in the world, as far as I'm concerned, but there are many better and more principled positions. Sanders just doesn't have much interesting to say there. And as far as Clinton, I mean, you know, she, regardless, from just by virtue of being Secretary of State, is going to be hitched to this Obama administration legacy. So I think it was a very good move for her from purely a, you know, tactical standpoint to just double down on it and not look like she's flip-flopping or being disrespectful of the president.
Not to mention, I think it was a shrewd maneuver on her part, a political maneuver, to send a message to Joe Biden that if you get into this race, that you're not going to be able to distinguish yourself from me on this issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's exactly right. I want to play a clip in a few minutes here on the gun debate between O'Malley and Sanders, which I found really interesting. But let me go to the phones first. Join us here with your thoughts at 410-319-8888 and give us your thoughts on last night's debate. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. And Leo, line 2, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Leo Burrows.
And good morning, Jill Carter.
Good morning.
Everyone. Well, when did Martin O'Malley save 1,000 black lives? I mean, you know, come on. What? Martin O'Malley is Mr. Zero Tolerance. What was he doing on the stage trying to uplift the negative image that he's always had among black folks in Baltimore and in the state of Maryland? Obviously, Hillary Clinton is the favorite person, although she is representative of the status quo. It reminds me, Mark, of what the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan said at the 20th anniversary meeting on Saturday, this past Saturday, of the Million Man March. Essentially, that both parties are not speaking to an agenda that speaks to the needs of African people and poor people in this country. So there was scuffling back and forth, but I think that in terms of foreign policy, both parties work to destabilize the Middle East. They destabilized Libya. They destabilized Egypt. They destabilized Afghanistan. You name it, both parties are sitting in the middle of the corporate arena, the international conglomerate of corporations who want war in that area. And Benjamin Netanyahu certainly is a provocateur. He's the man in the middle, and he wants war. I didn't hear enough of that address, but that's where we seem to be going. We're going in the direction of the drumbeat for war.
Well, that may be the case. I think that you also heard, at least what I heard of these candidates all talking about, most of them, was a reluctance to go to war. All of them none of them really wanted to talk about we need to bring a fight into.
And that's problematic, Mark, because they're still going for the post of commander-in-chief. So you have to be able to show at least a little bit of resolve. And again, you have to look at this. Bernie Sanders has been in Washington for a while. Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. And when you have the Chinese hacking our systems at the level that they're hacking them at, and you have Vladimir Putin literally giving a 60-minute notices of what they're going to do in an area that we don't want them to be in, along with some of the other things that have been going on around the world, you have to show a little bit of strength. Now, it doesn't mean that it has to be full-blown war hawk, but if you don't show strength as you're trying to go for this post to become the 45th president of the United States, it's going to be problematic. And in those two in particular, because they're at the top of the polls right now, one that has senatorial and congressional experience when it comes to foreign affairs, and the other one that was a seated Secretary of State, if you can't project that and you project more of we shouldn't do this, we need to back away, only diplomacy, that's not going to play well in swing states. It's going to be a little too to the left. And again, Hillary Clinton can't worry about the people in the room so much as she has to worry about who she's going to need to speak to next October, not this October.
Now, let me push back on that a little bit. One of the things I think that, Bhaskar, about this election, the elections I've seen in the past, the last several elections we've seen for the House, this election coming up, is that America's lines are drawn in the sand here. To those who are Republican, lean Republican. Those who are Democrats lean towards the Democrats or would surround Democrats. And that I think the majority of people who lean that way are saying you want a commander-in-chief, lean Democrat. You want a commander-in-chief who is going to be resolute but not commit ourselves to get in the middle of a mix. And there are even some Republicans on that side too. But I think that some of these lines are already drawn. I'm not so sure. I think the question is going to be who convinces their camp that their policies are the ones they should follow and bring them out to vote.
Well, I mean, I think that there's – I think we can't overestimate to the extent to which there's an exhaustion among the American people or even the broad middle, the people who before might have been able to go along with something like Afghanistan or Iraq. I think today's there's a sense of when the U.S. projects its power overseas, bad things happen. And that's not, you know, I generally agree with that. I think that of course, I have a different sort of critique. It's not an isolationist critique. It's the idea of critiquing the structures of U.S. foreign policy, the way it's connected to our domestic policy, and pushing for something more progressive, which is slightly different than just saying America first, let's not pay attention to foreign entanglements. But I do think there's that exhaustion. And I think that Sanders can really play to that in a way that I see only the libertarian right playing to right now. And I think that's where he really missed an opportunity. But, you know, as far as the Jim Webb rhetoric, I mean, maybe this is just me, but I thought Webb's rhetoric about China and then some of his other rhetorical flourishes, his last closing statement where he ended by talking about shooting someone, I think this is very out of touch for a Democratic debate. And maybe it wouldn't even fly some of those excesses in a Republican debate, but maybe that's, you know, giving them too much credit.
I think before we go to break, Marcia, just coming very quickly with that, I think that was odd. The way he closed was odd. And I think it was a different Jim Webb than the man I remember interviewing a couple of times. He just seemed very stilted and very nervous about being up on the stage and unsure. But I think many Americans might agree with him around China. I think that's a popular viewpoint about China. But Marcia, your thoughts? I'm going to go to break. Marcia? Did we lose Marcia? All right, let's go to break and come right back and see if we can find Marcia. we'll come back to all of our panelists. Don't go away. We're going to come back and we're going to hear a clip around gun control. We're going to look at issues of race and banking and more. We can come back 410-319-8888 in finance. Stay with us.
Time to stand up and pass comprehensive gun safety legislation as a nation.
Senator Sanders, I want you to be able to respond. 30 seconds.
I think the governor gave a very good example about the weaknesses in that law, and I think we have to take another look at it. But here is the point, Governor. We can raise our voices, But I come from a rural state, and the views on gun control in rural states are different than in urban states, whether we like it or not. Our job is to bring people together around strong, common sense gun legislation. I think there is a vast majority in this country who want to do the right thing, and I intend to lead the country in bringing
Senator,
our people together
Senator,
on that
me.
Issue.
Senator, excuse me. Senator, it was not about rural and
exactly
urban.
About
Have you
rural.
Ever been to the Eastern Shore? Have you ever been to Western Maryland? We were able to pass this and still respect the hunting traditions of people who live in our rural areas. And we did it,
Governor,
Anderson, by leading with principle, not by pandering to the NRA
well,
and backing down to the NRA.
Well, if voting record,
and
I
have an
quite, I don't think I am pandering.
Senator.
But you have not been in the United States Congress.
Well, maybe
and
that's
when
a
you
healthy
wanna
thing.
Check it out. And if you think that we can simply go forward and pass something tomorrow without bringing people together, you are surely mistaken.
Let me bring
mistaken.
In somebody who has a...
So that was an interesting... So tell me what you all think about how this gun control piece played out here. Again, this is Martin O'Malley kind of placing himself on as the great progressive governor, Jill Carter.
Well, first of all, to be honest with you, I don't think the discussion about guns really addresses the real issues. I think they speak very much to white rural America when they talk about their gun positions on gun control. And that's what happened here in Maryland. And let's be clear, the NRA is not super strong here in Maryland, and it wasn't an issue for O'Malley because Democrats outnumber Republicans, and it was almost a slam dunk to get that done. It was much easier to get that done here in Maryland. The comprehensive gun legislation that in no way addresses illegal guns. but that's an interesting slip because I really think that's the core issue. The same thing that has occurred with drugs, where there was never any effort to go after the large sale wholesalers, the importers and the like. There's also a reluctance to address illegal guns and transportation and illegal gun dealers. And that's what's causing all of the violence and the problem here in Baltimore in particular. And so, you can regulate legal gun ownership all you want, and at the end of the day, it's not going to have a lot of impact on violence. And so all of them miss the issue, in my opinion.
Lenny?
She's right. And, that's part of what Republicans actually say. Why are you trying to restrict the gun rights for those that are abiding by the rules? And those that abide by the rules for 5-10 years and then one day snap, you're not going to be able to prevent them from killing people either. I mean, some of that is a mental health issue, and some of this is about illegal guns. It's about enforcing laws that are already on the books. It's about enforcing the straw man laws that are on the books to prevent guns going from legal gun owners and purchasers to those that should not have guns, whether they're a felon or anything else, or underage or anything else along those lines. And she's correct. You know, when it came to Bernie Sanders versus Martin O'Malley, to sit there and continue to brag about all these accomplishments that he got done in Maryland is like saying that, I got a whole bunch of people to root for the Pittsburgh Steelers in Pittsburgh. It's
right.
going to happen.
At the end
Go
of the
Baltimore
day,
and do that.
The comprehensive gun legislation had no impact here.
Yeah, so right. at some point
in time,
you're going to have to sit there and say, what did you do to move the ball forward when you had to bring people together or you had a tough road to hoe?
Oscar?
Yeah, I actually largely agree. I mean, I think this gun control, the way the debate is framed, is largely a distraction from key issues. And Sanders did allude to these broader issues of mental health and the type of society where people can actually get the help that they need without any stigma, free and universal. And also, I mean, just in general, you could have a society with a high percentage of gun ownership. I have no desire to ever own or touch a gun, but you could have a society with a high percentage of gun ownership and have not a lot of gun violence. I think there's broader issues at play, and often it's a distraction. It's an easy way for traditional, machine liberals in cities to score easy talking points. And, so I think largely the way these debates are framed is kind of it's in a cheap and demagogic way.
One of the things that struck me as interesting, and I don't know how much this affected people who viewed this debate or how much it affects America at large, but I think it does have some effect, is when the young African-American law student on Facebook asked the question about Black Lives Matter. I found that really interesting. Very clear, concise, boom, here's the question. And it seemed as if on that stage, the only person who could really wrestle with that in a deep way was Bernie Sanders, who just has lately come to the game and I think learned this during the campaign in terms of what this is about. Maybe he's gotten some depth in the last month, which is fine. But I mean, but Hillary seemed to not be able to handle the question. I think maybe think about her kind of hand to the white working class voters that she called them, the true Americans, in that last campaign that she ran against Barack Obama. And the others seem to be really befuddled by the question in many ways. So what's your analysis of what that meant, the depth of it? Didn't take a lot of time in the debate, but to me, it really stood out.
First of all, I thought that the question was awkward because I thought it wasn't an either or. But I understand what the student was attempting to do. But I said last night, Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley already had their dress rehearsal, and it's interesting that Bernie did at least learn something from his, but O'Malley still couldn't bring himself to even address couldn't even deal with the issue. I think that. The question should have been, do Black Lives Matter and why? And I think that Hillary didn't address the issue at all because she feels very safe in not doing so. At the end of the day, the Democrat nominee knows that it's going to come down to the Democrat versus the Republican, and that historically and even now, Black population is going to go 90%, if not more, with the Democrat nominee, whoever that might be. So I think she's just letting Bernie, you know, kind of be outspoken on these issues to bring people in. And I think it's sad because I think that we're still not at a point where serious Democrat establishment candidates think that it's a significant enough issue to address something that so deeply affects the America at large and the Black people. And of course, there's no discussion whatsoever about race and race issues.
I think you're right in some ways. We'll turn to Bhaskar and then go to Lenny. That this particular issue, she does not know how to tackle this issue and won't. And I think that it's also she thinks she's safe because when you look at the polling, older Black voters down south are voting for Hillary. As someone said to me here, who's an activist, he said, "You know, I'm voting for Bernie, but when I talked to my parents, they went, 'There's no way I'm not voting for Hillary.' You know, so I mean that's." She feels safe without having to even commit to anything.
So I agree completely that Bernie Sanders was kind of trained and prepared for this and adopted and changed his rhetoric, I think, for the better after the two Black Lives Matter interventions at his events. But I do think that when we look at this polling, people often say Bernie Sanders is lagging behind Clinton because he's not addressing these issues in the way Clinton is or whatever. But if you actually look, you could say that Hillary Clinton's benefiting from two things. One, in general, Black voters, particularly older Black voters, are the staunchest Democratic partisans as far as voting patterns. And also, Bernie Sanders still has a relatively low level of voter identification, particularly in states like an early primary state like South Carolina. So honestly, I think that can be explained away. And as things develop, if 3-4 months down the road or 2-3 months down the road, if Bernie Sanders' poll numbers in South Carolina, these other places, still don't improve at all, then you could say something about his message isn't resonating. But I actually think that his message, the broadly populist message for economic redistribution, will in fact resonate with voters, particularly Black voters. And I do think that this other thing is that, you know, I think often these staunch partisan voters, I just mean partisan as far as voting patterns, voting consistently for Democrats, often are impacted by the bandwagon effect a bit. Like once Sanders' poll numbers go up a little bit, once he looks viable, then he's gonna have a chance. You know, my own parents, I often talk to them about voting, telling them to vote for Sanders, and they say, you know, what does Sanders stand for? I say, free public education. So they say, oh, that sounds good, but he's not going to win. And they're going to support Hillary Clinton. Now they're saying, oh, Sanders is looking pretty good, but, you know, the powers that be really don't want the people educated, so Sanders is not going to win. So that's another thing to kind of get people to actually believe and hope and not just go with the presumed, you know, favorite.
Lenny?
Well, you know, she does feel safe. And when Bernie Sanders basically lets her off the hook in regards to the email server scandal, and Martin O'Malley follows that up, then that's the reason why she said, thank you, Bernie. I mean, she shook his hand and a huge smile on her face. I thought she was going to jump into his arms. I mean, that's how excited she was in regards to having a fellow Democrat take one of the biggest things that's been a headache for her off the table. So if that's going to be the case, why would she wade into those waters right then and there? And truth be told, let's just be very honest, if it ends up being Ben Carson as the nominee, if it ends up being Donald Trump as the nominee, if it ends up being some of the other Republicans on the other side who have not spoken to race very well at all, why would you even wade into that waters? Because then it's still a choice between either a Republican Party and a Republican nominee with a bad reputation and a whole bunch of horrible quotes and sentiments versus somebody that has the good sense to keep her mouth shut and not dive into those waters. And as long as she has that as the primary choice in front of her, why would she say anything? It's smart politics. It's not good leadership, but it's smart politics.
Right, and I think the Republicans would, I mean, the Democrats would love to see Donald Trump or Ben Carson as the nominee. It'd be very
for
happy.
For the reasons that I just named, right, among others, but for the reasons I just named.
So, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. We're going to hit a different topic here. Marsha, you back with us? Not yet? Okay, I thought she was back. 410-319-8888. Kenneth, you're on the air.
Right. My opinion is, excuse me, doesn't matter who is nominated, if we don't get a handle on immigration, it's not going to matter what we do. Immigration is the most number one thing in this country that we need to deal with. Or we're going to wake up one morning and we're going to have a country to have a president for, okay? Immigration. Thank you.
Well, they did talk about immigration last night, and I think very clearly most of them did.
Well, we need to get a handle on that now.
Okay, so what do we think about that? I mean, so they all did kind of approach immigration. It was a major question that came up. They approached it in a very different way than Republicans approached it. But
yeah, I would give them some credit there. I think in general, the candidates approached the issues humanely, and you know, I hate to say anything nice about the man just because of how much I know Maryland and Baltimore suffered under him. But O'Malley, you know, approached the question, that particular question, pretty well. I think what's important is just to explain to people that, you know, we understand the pressures that you're under, but your enemies aren't a bunch of other workers trying to find work, because, in fact, these people are going to be contributing to society and to the economy and is actually, you know, people that you want as your friends and neighbors. The problem is your enemy at home, the people you're already you know, dealing with, this small class of people that are making your life miserable. And I think that's a perfect answer and a rebuttal for someone like Sanders. It is disappointing that he's takes a more tepid and conventional tone. But, you know, compared to what you're hearing on the Republicans on this, you know, I'll give the Democrats much more credit.
One of the things that struck me about what you said, Martin O'Malley, is that looking at my Twitter feed back and forth last night, the people who are local to Baltimore, Maryland, have a lot of angst about Martin O'Malley across the board. But most of America doesn't. So what we were concerned about it when he was mayor of Baltimore, most Americans don't even know what that's about. So but what they do know, what they did here, even though he came off very wooden sometimes, and as I think is the most politician-like of all the debaters, like a real politician, kind of stiff. But some of the things he said did appeal to Latino voters, did appeal to young voters. You know, I think that's why I said that in my tweets, I thought that in some ways he may rise slightly in the polls just because of the answers
he
gave.
I think he rise, but very slightly in the polls. And I think that
for like 2-4%.
He did his talking points really well, the ones that he was spoon-fed so that he could distinguish himself in the debate and in the race. But I think he didn't go far enough because he probably doesn't have the ability to really articulate what he represents. And he didn't say he said we need new leadership. I will be comprehensive, progressive on immigration issues. But at the end of the day, he didn't say, well, you know, I'm the candidate. I am the new leadership. He couldn't really. Well, he did point to the Dream Act in Maryland, but I just don't really see, and maybe I missed it, a huge distinction amongst the Democrat candidates. I think that's a strictly partisan issue, the ideology. But nobody is going to talk about America's contribution to the conditions in other places that result in the need for people to come here. And that's what the conversation I think that needs to have, but it's not going to happen.
So I one of the things, and Len, do you want to jump in at all on that before we go to another subject?
On immigration?
Yeah, just very quickly.
I mean, again, Martin O'Malley touted the Dream Act that was passed in Maryland.
Right.
And it's like wearing black and gold in Pittsburgh or wearing, you know, rapper colors in Baltimore.
Well,
and
actually, it was pretty...
going to have the fans there. Of course he's going to have the numbers. That's not an accomplishment. And, you know, for somebody that also got smacked down with, hey, you haven't been in Congress, you don't know what this is like, and that's what Bernie Sanders did with Governor O'Malley on the gun issue, he can only go but so far. Then he kind of has to wade in the waters. And if he's not going to sit there and be visionary and be inspirational and aspirational, then again, he's better than Chafee and Webb. But it goes back to, why are you on stage if you're not going to do those things, if you're not going to fill that void? Because again, Barack Obama had a pretty thin record himself in 2007 going into 2008, but he filled the inspiration void, and that's how he got wind in his sails.
No. I think that there's a lot of reasons why the Obama got wind in his sails. That's not necessarily in this particular race in anybody, in the two races he ran. But I think I also just put out there, Lenny, that the Dream Act in Maryland was not such an easy sell. That was a battle, because immigration is a battle everywhere, and it was a real fight in the state legislature around that issue.
I believe it took about 4 years, and to be honest with you, and I don't. I'm not going to say O'Malley wasn't initially in support, but it wasn't a priority for him at all,
right.
And he didn't help to push it at all, and it took the activists and advocates and the legislature actually to really push that issue.
Like the delegate who's sitting with us. So let's go 410-319-8888. Going to go to the phones here, but one thing I wanted to raise was the one that we talked about a little bit earlier, but O'Malley pushing Glass-Steagall, Bernie Sanders pushing hard on the power of the 1% and how it's destroying America from the inside. Hillary in some ways trying to play the balanced presidential role and how you would handle that. But that's going to be – that was a major issue last night that I think that that also distinguished itself in the Republican debate in terms of how to address that. But and I think a lot of people, conservative, moderate, and liberal, are worried about this in America. So how do you think that played out last night with all the different candidates?
You know, I'm biased because I know O'Malley more than the other candidates, you know, personally. I know Hillary's record, but I don't know much about Sanders prior to all of this. What the Glass-Steagall issue didn't resonate with me because it's something that should have been addressed, and it likely won't in the Congress, and to be honest with you. But O'Malley had an opportunity here to address the issue, the difference between commercial banking and the other, and he didn't. And we were number one for many of the years until his end in foreclosures or in the top three in the country. And so I think it's a lot of rhetoric there. I think, of course, Bernie Sanders resonates with wanting to crack down on the Wall Street bankers. But at the end of all of this, the Democrat leadership in the Congress, which includes the two of them, have been complicit in the current situation that we have. So I don't have a lot of hope that there's any real substance behind that rhetoric, but the rhetoric is good, and Bernie's was the best.
So I think there's a real debate to have on the left and among radicals about whether you believe that you could operate in Democratic primaries and whether you think that you can at all, right? And that's a debate that we could have on Bernie Sanders. You know, I myself come down on the side of supporting Sanders, but I think what really was shown in that segment when they were talking about banks and Wall Street is the fact that Sanders' rhetoric is completely different, partially because he's not a Democrat, he's not a liberal, he's not from these political traditions. He came out of a very different political milieu, a very different political tradition. You know, he was an independent radical mayor in Burlington. He ran as an independent in Congress. He's someone who has done a record that was released in the late 70s where he did nothing but recite speeches from Eugene Debs.
Right. The socialist candidate in the 1920s and teens.
Right, exactly. Right. So he knows this radical tradition. And if anything, what he does is he takes some of the cores of this tradition, and he puts a different gloss on it. Occasionally he'll use more liberal language and so on, but he's someone who's translating radical thought, and that I think is unique. And you could say that it's unique and it's still bad, and I could, you know, respectfully have that debate, but I think that really really showed the difference. So if Bernie disappointed a little bit when it came to immigration, but really disappointed when it came to foreign policy. I think here is where he was in his comfort zone. Here was, you know, Sanders at his very best.
Let's play this quick clip, and then we're going to go to Eric on the phone, and I have a question about marijuana and the candidates. But let's play this clip first. Oh, I thought we had the clip ready. I'm sorry. Oh, the computer's not loading. Okay, well, it's loading now. Okay, here we go. This is the exchange told me about capitalism.
You don't consider yourself a capitalist, though.
Do I consider myself part of the casino capitalist process by which so few have so much and so many have so little, by which Wall Street's greed and recklessness wreck this economy? No, I don't. I believe in a society where all people do well, not just a handful of billionaires.
Just so let me just be clear, is there any bill, anybody else on the stage who's not a capitalist?
Well, let me just follow up on that, Anderson, because when I think about capitalism, I think about all the small businesses that were started because we have the opportunity and the freedom in our country for people to do that and to make a good living for themselves and their families. And I don't think we should confuse what we have to do every so often in America, which is save capitalism from itself. And I think what Senator Sanders is saying certainly makes sense in the terms of the inequality that we have. But we are not Denmark. I love Denmark. We are the United States of America, and it's our job to rein in the excesses of capitalism so that it doesn't run amok and doesn't cause the kind of inequities that we're seeing in our economic system. But we would be making a grave mistake to turn our backs on what built the greatest middle class in the history
Senator
of the world.
Senator Sanders?
I mean, everybody is in agreement that we are a great entrepreneurial nation. We have got to encourage that. Of course, we have to support small and medium-sized businesses. But you can have all of the growth that you want, and it doesn't mean anything if all of the new income and wealth is going to the top 1%. So what we need to do is support small and medium-sized.
So in some ways, it felt like it was the Sanders-Clinton debate with a little kind of dash of O'Malley here and there and very few herbs on the side from the other two into this too. But that was kind of typical of what I thought.
Yeah, and that question, the way it was framed is just ridiculous. Are you a capitalist? Just think about like what they're actually saying. Like, Bernie Sanders, do you own a bunch of factories? Do you own some sweatshops? Do you employ labor? You know, it's the way this debate is framed. It's basically, are you serious or are you not? And I think he acquitted himself pretty well. And it was very funny to see Clinton have to argue on these terms, which obviously she's not very very much used to having this argument. So, I mean, her last response was just purely, all right, I know I'm losing some momentum, so I'm just going to turn on the demagogue switch and pretend like Denmark's some sort of Soviet, you know, republic and not another capitalist state.
It was kind of it was a FDR response that we have to save capitalism from itself.
Sure. I thought Hillary just simply evaded the question and confused the two issues with capitalism versus free enterprise. And I think that switching it to small businesses that is a little different was disingenuous. And I also think that you start with the evils of capitalism, you have to include the issue of campaign finance reform, which, of course, the only one that speaks to that is Bernie Sanders.
4103, we're going to come right back to Lenny. 410-319-8888. Eric, line 3, you're on the air.
Okay. First of all, I don't have a lot of time, so I have to cover this real fast.
Go.
The reason our ancestors passed the wave of regulation during the 30s and 40s on the banks and everything is precisely to prevent this level of corporate thievery and thuggery and theft that we see today. As soon as the conservatives, both Democrat and Republicans, rolled back regulations in the 60s and 70s on the banks, all of a sudden, you started seeing waves of bank failures, the S&L crisis, et cetera,
right,
et cetera. Secondly, I do not believe in campaign finance reform. I believe in campaign finance elimination. It is theft. It is corruption of government. And as long as you have campaign financing, you got the Nimrod that you have in Congress, but Republicans in particular. Thirdly, we have had, since the Sandy Hook massacre, we have had over 125 different school shootings. Thousands of Americans have been killed and wounded. not a single, yet when the Center of Disease
Control
wanted to do a study on the roots of gun violence, the dominated, Republican-dominated House of Representatives stopped it dead cold.
All right, Eric, we're just about out of time. I'm just being heard from my producer. I apologize. Let me get to my last words here from our guests. And just wondering, as we get our last words, we'll start with Lenny and go to Jill Carter and then the bus car. I wonder why they only asked the marijuana question to Hillary and Bernie. Anyway, Lenny, go ahead. Very quickly, last comment.
Well, last comment is we got what we expected to get out of last night's debate, which is Hillary Clinton on top, still on top, untouched and unchallenged. And if Joe Biden doesn't jump into this race, it's probably going to stay that way until next summer.
Oscar.
Well, Hillary Clinton is going to be the next president of the United States, it seems like. And the real question is, for people like me, for people supporting Bernie Sanders, for people who think like he's bringing something different to the table, is what are you going to do when he tells you to support Hillary Clinton? I hope that we take this energy and this momentum and do something different with it, you know, build social movements and do other things.
So Carter.
I agree completely with that, and I think that is the challenge. And at the end of the day, when Bernie Sanders does do that, which happens it's all the time. Typical play in these kind of campaigns, what are true young people, progressives, and people that really want reform going to do? I suggest it is use this opportunity to move away from the two-party system.
Well, I'm going to thank all three of you. It's always great to have you on the air, and it's good to have you together on the air. Linda McAllister joining us from Pittsburgh, Republican strategist, host of Night Talk, Get to the Point on Pittsburgh Cable, Bhaskar Sunkara, who is founding director of Jacobin Magazine and a senior editor in These Times, Delegate Jill Carter, who represents the 44th District here in Baltimore, in the Maryland House Delegates from Baltimore, and Marsha Reeve Jews, who joined us earlier, who's the host of Keep It Moving on WEAA. We'll be right back. We look at Tamir Rice, the latest from Freddie Gray's trial, and more coming up in the next half an hour of The Mark Steiner Show. Stay with us. Don't go away.